You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Our guest today is Dr. David Cooper. He is a heart transplant surgeon and professor of surgery at the Thomas E. Starles Transplantation Institute at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. In the late 1970s, he was a member of the team that performed the first successful series of heart transplants in the UK. Since then, he has held faculty positions at the University of Cape Town Medical School in South Africa, Harvard Medical School, and other institutions. Widely published in his field, he holds three doctorate degrees and is a fellow of both the Royal College of Surgeons of England and the American College of Surgeons. We're really happy to have him with us today talking about the history of heart transplantation and his new book, Open Heart. Please welcome Dr. David Cooper.
Well, thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate it. I'm a little nervous because I see at the back here a very well-known medical historian who is at your university. And so I immediately tell you that this is not really an erudite medical history book. It is a book that is a labor of love that I've written over the last 20 years, mainly through my interest in the development of heart surgery. And it's based on my personal interviews with most of the people who were involved in this field. Most of them were still alive when I met with them. Several of them have died since then. One or two had already died, but I had the opportunity to meet either their trainees or their colleagues or somebody or other, so I could get a personal opinion either from them or about them. And so it was very interesting for me to put this together. So it is you might call it an oral history in that I've actually spoken to the people that were closely involved. Now, I'm not going to go through the whole book because it obviously take me much too long, and please feel free to stop me and ask me any questions if you like as we go along. But it's a story that begins in the late 1930s and ends in the early 1980s. That was the period of time, 40, 50 years, when all these developments took place. Completely new field of surgery. There's a lovely quote from somebody in 1890, I think it was a British surgeon, saying that, you know, the surgery of the heart had reached its pinnacle in 1890. And so it was a completely new field of surgery. And what was perhaps very exciting about it, and that's why I got involved in it when I was a medical student in London, is that it was a very constructive form of surgery. A lot of surgery is what you might call destructive. You take something out that's diseased, or you remove a boil, you lance a boil or something. It's not very constructive, but heart surgery was one of the most constructive forms of surgery. And in the last 100 years, the two great breakthroughs, certainly last 50 years, the two great breakthroughs in surgery were heart surgery and transplantation. And obviously, heart transplantation puts the two together. I'll come back to this in a minute, but it's amazing to me that nobody in heart surgery got a Nobel Prize for what they did. Because it's been of benefit to millions of people worldwide. And it was constructive because a lot of the conditions that your children were born with heart defects, required some constructive repair. Rather than just taking out something with disease, they needed a repair. And even subsequently, when you had valves being replaced, it was a constructive operation. Coronary artery surgery is constructive in a way. You bring a vein graft around to block bypass a blockade and so on and so on. And heart transplantation is constructive in a way. You're putting in something new, not just taking something out that's bad. Now, one of the reasons the publishers wanted me to come to Minneapolis was because a lot of this work took place in Minneapolis. In fact, the greatest, in my opinion, the greatest contributor to this field was Walton Lillehei, who was a professor of cardiac surgery here. He was a very controversial character, as I'll tell you a bit in a minute. I met him many times, and I always enormously admired him and liked him. And really, this was the place, Minneapolis, where I think the whole thing really took off. There was some work before it and some work after it, but this, to my mind, was the center of where this development really took place. So before Minneapolis, there were some efforts made. The first big step forward was really not in the heart. It was surgery of a vessel, an abnormal blood vessel that babies were born with that should have closed down and sealed itself off, that was just outside the heart. And the first person to deal with that was Robert Gross in Boston. And he was, it's a very interesting story. He was a senior a resident at the time, chief resident. And he came up with the idea that maybe if we tied this thing off, because if it persisted, it led to heart failure in children, and usually in their early life, in 5, 6, 7 years old, they went into severe heart failure and died. So he suggested to his boss, who was the professor of pediatric surgery there at the Boston Children's Hospital, that maybe we should tie this thing off. And the boss said, no, 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 it'd be too dangerous, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he waited till his boss was out of town on a boat going to Britain. And he waited 3 days till he was out of too far to turn around. And he brought in two patients. And he thought that if one dies, then he'll do the other one. And if one survives, then he'll prove that it could be done. Luckily, they both survived. And when his boss came back, he fired him. And the pediatricians and the cardiologists there said, look, you know, this is such a step forward. You know, these children usually die, and here's two children who are now going to be alive and well. And they more or less put pressure on him to reappoint this young man. Interestingly enough, although Gross was a very great surgeon, he actually, when he became chairman of the department himself, he really couldn't stand much competition, and anybody who was any good that came along, if they were going to go somewhere else, that was fine. But if they stayed in his department, he rather suppressed them and didn't really let them do anything. So what happened, in fact, was that most of the bright people left, and the ones he surrounded himself were not so able. So he was a controversial character himself. So that was the beginning. And then there were other procedures done outside the heart, but which influenced the condition inside the heart. You couldn't correct it inside the heart, so you try to correct it by doing something outside the heart to sort of rebalance it. And that was done mainly at Johns Hopkins, and also where I trained in London, in Guy's Hospital Medical School, where, and I think that's what influenced me to go into cardiac surgery. We had one of the leading cardiac surgeons in Britain there at the time. And so they began to realize that you could do something about these heart diseases. And the next step was to what we call closed heart surgery. You couldn't open the heart because obviously all the blood would come out and you couldn't do anything about it. But you could put a finger into the heart with it beating. And there was a condition known as mitral stenosis, where one of the valves in the heart would get obstructed. It would stenose down, it would contract down because of rheumatic fever, as a late effect of rheumatic fever. And there were surgeons both in this country and in the UK who decided that if they put a finger in the heart, they could push it through this valve and maybe open it up again. And three of them did this within about a month of each other, quite independently. And this was the first step of actually operating really inside the heart. And the patients with mitral stenosis, we don't see it today, partly because rheumatic fever is very relatively uncommon now, because we have antibiotics and so on, but also partly because we can do something about it at an early stage. But in those days, they were left to die, basically. Talking to the surgeons who had seen these patients, even when I was training, that those patients were getting less common. They were incredibly sick. They were really moribund by the time they, you know, got operated on. So the mortality was really quite high at that period. And again, later on, when Walt Lillehei was doing his open heart surgery here, the mortality was high. It was estimated that about 1 in 3 patients would die on the operating table or soon afterwards. And a recent a contemporary cardiac surgeon said, can you imagine going to work each day and having every third patient die on you on the operating table or soon afterwards? It must have taken a huge strain on these people. And there were not many people, I think, who could actually stand up to that. And that was one of Walt Lillehei's great qualities, that he seemed to be able to come back the next day and try again. I was had the great good fortune of working with Chris Barnard, who did the first heart transplant for several years in Cape Town. And he had trained with Walt Lillehei. He trained here in general cardiac surgery before he went and went back to South Africa. And he said he really admired Walt Lillehei. He said sometimes they would come in on a Monday, they'd operate on one patient every day, And by the end of the week, they had 5 dead patients. And he said the next Monday he would be there again, trying again, until they got it sort of right. So they were remarkable people. Tom Starzl, whose institute I work in now, is one of the founders of liver transplantation, particularly, and kidney transplantation. He called them the right stuff, the same thing that you called the astronauts. He said they had the right stuff. These were remarkable people, and I think they really were. So closed heart surgery came in where they could do something, but obviously there were things like holes in the heart they really couldn't do anything about. So people began to think, how can we actually operate inside the heart? And the first step forward in this respect was in about 1950, in the early 50s, when a surgeon in Toronto, Bill Bigelow, had the concept of cooling the patient down, hypothermia, because if your heart stops at normal body temperature, you have about 4 minutes before your brain will be irreversibly damaged because it gets no blood and oxygen. And he said, if you cool them down, like when you put meat in a refrigerator, it lasts longer because it needs less oxygen because it's cooler, its metabolism is reduced. So he had the concept of cooling patients down, either in a bath of cold water with ice, or on a cooling blanket where you put cold water through the blanket and cool them down. So there are different ways of doing it. And you could cool their temperature from a normal level of about 37 degrees, but down to about 30 degrees, and that would be safe. If you went much below that, your heart would stop. So there was a bit of a knife edge here. They cooled down, and they didn't want to get too cool, so they began to heat up again. And he did most of the experimental work on this, Bill Bigelow in Toronto, but he didn't do the first clinical case. He didn't do the first operation on a patient. And that was actually another surgeon here in Minneapolis. This is why Minneapolis, I think, is so important in the development of heart surgery. A man called John Lewis, who was a close friend of Walt Lilly High. I think they'd been in the same class as medical school. They'd both gone out to the Second World War, and both had distinguished careers as surgeons and physicians in the military in Europe. And when they came back, John Lewis heard about Bill Bigelow's work, which was in animals, and decided that he would develop this. So he did a lot of work in animals here to get this technique right, cooling down. Then you had 6 minutes, you could stop the heart, open it, close up the hole or whatever it was, and close the heart up again, take the clamps off, 6 minutes, and if you could do it in 6 minutes, the patient would do all right. So quite hairy surgery. I've seen it done. It had gone out of fashion by the time I was trained, but one or two old surgeons were still using it, and so I saw one or two cases like this, and it's certainly a risky surgery. And John Lewis was the mentor of Norman Shumway, who you've perhaps heard about, who really was the father of heart transplantation. And Shumway trained here. There were a lot of very great people trained here under Walt Lilly High and Lewis. I say Barnard was one, Shumway was another. People that went on to become very eminent surgeons themselves. And Norman Shumway always used to refer to John Lewis as the great John Lewis. He had a huge respect for him. But Lewis was not an easy person to get on with. At meetings, he would actually criticize his colleagues fairly substantially, and so he didn't have a lot of supporters at some place, sometime. And I met him when he'd long retired, and I'll read you a little bit from the book about him. And he was a very interesting person. He had done this fantastic operation, the first operation of anybody to operate inside the heart where he could actually see what he was doing. Now, in surgery, I don't think it comes much bigger than that. That's a big step forward, to be the first person to operate inside the heart when you can see what you're doing. So he'd reached this pinnacle, and quite interestingly, after that, he left here because the chairman of the department, Wangenstein, always liked, he wanted his boys to be around the country. He wanted them to be chairman everywhere. He was fairly ambitious in that respect. So Lewis left and he went to Northwestern in Chicago. And he didn't do very well there. He first of all, he told me he made a mistake. He wanted to continue doing all sorts of surgery. He should have concentrated on, say, heart surgery, but he wanted to do gallbladders and cancer surgery and all sorts of things. And he said this meant he was competing with all of his colleagues. And they were very competitive. They didn't like this. People didn't refer in patients because there were other surgeons doing the same sort of work. And then he had one or two not very good results with this surgery. He operated on one or two children of some fairly substantial people in Chicago, and it didn't work out very well, partly because the diagnosis was wrong, which it often was in those days. And so gradually his practice began to decline, and he more or less moved out of surgery into use of computers in medicine. He was one of the people that developed computers in intensive care units and so on. And he became rather disenchanted with the whole thing. And at the age of 59, he retired and drove out to California and took interest in all sorts of other things. During that retirement, he became divorced after many years marriage. So his whole life really sort of collapsed around him. And I'll read you a couple of bits about it. I flew out there to meet with him, and he was a very, very nice person. But let me just read one bit to him. He took me to where he was living. And here's this guy that's done this monumental surgery. For, by the way, he never got a single honorary degree or any accolade for doing that surgery. He was never, neither the public nor the medical profession gave him any awards or honors, which stunned me. But he said it didn't bother him, but it was really surprising. So his guest house apartment that I visited was situated in one of the suburbs of Santa Barbara. It was small and cramped. I presumed that he rented it, since the white painted walls were rather grubby and the rather faded green carpet was of poor quality. It was clear that he lived the existence of an elderly bachelor in relatively run-down circumstances. The scene was of a gentleman who had fallen on hard times. The apartment had one bedroom, one main room, a kitchen, and a bathroom. The main room was divided into a small area where there was a television and a sofa, and another area that looked more like a study or office. Here he had a table on which was his personal computer, a nearby filing cabinet, and some old bookcases filled with books. Another small table, which presumably acted as the dining table, was flanked by two director chairs, those canvas chairs that film directors use. On one wall, I noted a very good oil painting of some Southern Californian buildings, which was his own work. There were several other framed sketches of his, which to my relatively uneducated eye were not of such good quality. But here he was living in really a very basic little apartment. And that, first of all, struck me as being odd. Secondly, when I interviewed him, at one point he was telling me he had three children. He was telling me what they were doing in life, and one of them was had done something unusual. I think she was something to do with saving some sort of tree in the country, and she worked. That was what she did, and her husband, and they lived out in the wild somewhere, and they were dedicated to saving these trees. And it sounded very odd. So I said to him, "Well, at least she's happy." And he said to me, "Happy? They're not happy. Who the hell's happy?" And that struck me as very sad, that here's this guy in his 70s by this time, clearly not really happy. So what he did with his retirement, he did all sorts of things to try to improve himself. He took courses in mathematics. He learned to play the piano. He did all this artwork. He cycled all over Southern California. He wrote a little book about cycling around California. He always seemed to be trying to do something to improve himself. And obviously, it wasn't very successful. He wrote a book for the public about when to believe your surgeon and when not to believe your surgeon. I don't think he got that published. He wrote his own autobiography, which he gave me four little cyclist-styled Xerox copies. He could never get that published. So he did all these things without getting anything really published. And it was interesting to read his autobiography, though, because he put it fairly bluntly that, you know, life really hadn't quite worked out for him, I think. And I'll read you a little bit from the book here. His whole life seemed to have been a series of attempts at self-improvement, perhaps suggesting a deep-seated feeling of inadequacy. In his autobiography, he admits to a chronic interest in schemes for self-improvement. At various stages of his life, he undertook a private program of reading the great books, attended night school for several years to study mathematics, and tried off and on to learn the piano. And he said, "My ambition, which I freely confess to anyone, knowing all the while that I'll never achieve it, is to play and sing popular tunes at some local bar." And And I thought, here is this guy, this eminent surgeon who's done this fantastic thing, and he ends his days wanting to croon in a bar, accompanying himself with a piano. And he said, so far I haven't tried to sing, playing is difficult enough. And I thought, what a surprising ambition for a man who had taken this historic step in surgery. So he was a very interesting person, and I came away very sad, really, because life just, he hadn't got the accolades and rewards that I thought he deserved, and life had just not turned out very well for him. So that was the first great step forward, though, in Minneapolis. And then, that was in 1952. But they soon realized that if you have 6 minutes to operate inside the heart, there were really only one or two conditions that you could correct in that time. You couldn't replace a valve. You couldn't construct anything very new. All you could do really was one condition, which was just a hole, and you just cobbled it up. And you could do that if you were fairly quick. And so they still were looking around for something else to support the heart, or to support the patient while you stop the heart. And the first person to work on this was a man in Philadelphia who had worked on developing a heart-lung machine, a machine that would pump blood around, so it takes the place of the heart, but it would also oxygenate that blood and get rid of the carbon dioxide, take place of the lungs. And he was a guy called Gibbon, and he worked on this for over 20 years. He started in the late 20s when he had this concept, the idea of this concept, and he worked on it mainly to a large extent with his wife, who was a lab technician. And apart from the war years, they worked on it really consistently through till about 1953. And in the last 2 or 3 years, he was able to get help from IBM, the computer company, who actually were very helpful in sending their engineers to help him with no thought of getting any money back themselves. And I think he wouldn't have managed to do it without them. So he came up with a heart-lung machine. It was rather complex. They estimated it cost about $50,000 to put one together, so it was expensive for the time. And he did 4 operations. All 4 were the same sort of things they were doing with his hypothermia. And so it was not really much of an advance, because you could do it by hypothermia. But he did 4 operations, and only one of those 4 patients survived. The first died, second survived, and the next 2 died. And having worked on this for 20 years, he then decided, I'm going to give it up. And he decided he would never operate another patient. He did designate one of his junior colleagues to do it, but basically he dropped out. And he said they needed to go back to the laboratory and work on it. But even though the machine was okay, but he and I asked very many surgeons, why did he do that after 20 years effort? And they said that basically he didn't like the deaths. He was mainly a lung surgeon, not a heart surgeon, and he wasn't used to, he'd not gone through this phase that these others had gone through, having a high mortality and 3 out of 4 patients dying, and he just didn't want to do it anymore. So he was more of a physiologist than a real surgeon in that respect. So here we had this one patient who'd been operated on successfully, and 3 who hadn't, and they were still stuck. How could they operate on patients whose hearts needed some more than 6 minutes reconstruction? And so that's where Walt Lillehei comes onto the scene. And he had a lab here, and he was doing chest surgery. He was doing some of these closed operations I talked about and this sort of thing. And he was a young man. He'd come out of the army at the end of the war and done his residency then. He hadn't done the residency before the war, so he'd only just got onto the faculty in the early 1950s. And he had 1 or 2 research fellows. He was renowned that anybody that wrote and said they'd like to come and work with him, he took them into his group. He said, you never know who's going to come up with a bright idea. So he was very open about this. And I'll actually read you one little story, which is not really related to Lillehei, but it gives you an idea of the people he had here. And this was a man called Aldo Castaneda, who was a research fellow and clinical fellow here. He was a very gifted surgeon, and he actually became chief of surgery at the Boston Children's Hospital after Robert Gross, that we mentioned earlier. So he was a very gifted person. But he's a remarkable man, and I talked to him on the telephone, and he told me this story, how he came to be here and to train here. And I'll just read it to you because it's quite interesting. He was born in Guatemala, and he was a medical student in Guatemala, not a place noted for its scientific advances in medicine. But as a medical student, he designed his own heart-lung machine, and he operated on some dogs. So he was a very driven sort of young man. And they were having a congress in Guatemala. I forgot what the topic was, psychiatry or something. And a psychiatrist or physician from here was one of the guest speakers. And as Castaneda was very fluent in English as well as Spanish, they asked him, would he translate this guest speaker's talk, concomitantly as he was going on. And all the people in the audience wore headphones, and so Castaneda was sitting at the side translating. And it was a psychiatrist, pediatric psychiatrist from Minnesota, gave one of the lectures in English, Castaneda translating into Spanish. And he did well for a while, but then the speaker began to relate a long-winded and possibly not very funny Scandinavian joke, which, of course, Castaneda said, I didn't understand. So as the joke unfolded, Castaneda in Spanish informed his audience through their headphones that a joke was being told, but that he couldn't understand it and he could not translate it for them. However, after the obvious punchline, although unintelligible to the translator, Castaneda told everybody through the headphones that they should laugh, and they obliged him by laughing heartily. The speaker was extremely impressed that the joke had been translated so well and had proved so successful. After his lecture, he thanked Castaneda profusely and offered any help he could provide to the young man's career. So Castaneda took the opportunity to bring up his keen interest in obtaining training in open-heart surgery in Minneapolis. The professor returned to Minneapolis and told Wangenstein, who was the chairman of the department, there's this genius in Guatemala, and I think you should offer him a job, which they did. So that's how he came to be here, and I say he went on to very great things. Now, how did Lillehei attack this problem of having some way of supporting the heart of the patient, supporting the circulation of the patient while you stop the heart? And he had a research fellow from Canada, from Winnipeg, and this research fellow was working on ways of trying to do this, and it just happened that his wife was pregnant at the time. And so he thought, it's a pity we can't have somebody, you're supporting the circulation of this baby. If we could just do something like that, maybe we could have an answer. So he went to Lillehei and told him, this idea. So they thought, well, if they had a big patient and they linked up the blood supply to the little child, the big patient could support the circulation of both of them while they stopped the heart in the child and operated on it. And that would give them more than 6 minutes. And now, this was an operation with a potential mortality of 200%. Most operations, it's 100%. But here's one, you could kill the donor and you could kill the recipient. And they worked on it in the lab with a big dog and a little dog, and they got it to work consistently. So then Lillehei thought he would operate on a patient. And he got, I think it was the father, to be the heart-lung machine, and the little boy, the patient. And they had a little difficulty getting it through the administration here at the hospital, because I think they were worried about the medico-legal side of things. But they were quite upfront with the patient and the patient's family that, this hadn't been done before. There was a big risk. There was a risk involved. They didn't think it was a big risk, but there was a risk involved. And people signed consent forms to do this. And this proved really quite successful. They did about 44 patients in a row, and well over half of the children survived, and all of the donors, or the blood, the donors survived, although one did have some brain damage. But that wasn't through this technique. It was that the anesthesiologist was pumping in some blood into the donor and failed to notice. When you pump it under pressure, you can pump air in. Failed to notice that he pumped some air in, and the air went to the brain, and the air acts like a clot and blocks the supply. And so that patient was brain damaged. I think I understand not too badly, but never could really function, 100% afterwards. And Lillehei said to the patient and her family, said, look, I'm insured. I've got some medical insurance. You should sue me, and then you'll get some money to help look after you for the rest of your life. And So he was very open about it. He said, "I'm sure the hospital will go along with this." Well, unfortunately, she got hold of a lawyer who sued the hospital for millions, and the hospital felt they couldn't agree to this, and so they had to go to court, and she lost the case because she had signed this consent form saying she was well aware there was a risk involved to her and so on. But she was the only one, my understanding, that had any injury from this experience. So this was a very risky thing to do. If we were going to do this today, I mean, there would be a lot of people throwing up their arms and saying it's too risky. So it was a very risky thing. The only operation I know that's worse from a potential mortality point of view is that some children who need bilateral lung transplants, they have a lobe of the lung from the father and a lobe of the lung from the mother. So here you've got a potential 300% mortality, but as far as I'm aware, none of the donors have died from that. But for example, when we do liver transplants, which Pittsburgh is one of the leading centers, and our liver transplant program, by the way, is now run by somebody who just came a couple of years ago from Minneapolis, we take part of the liver from a living donor and put it into a patient, and there, I know of at least, not at Pittsburgh, thank goodness, but I know worldwide of at least 20 donors who have died after that procedure. So here we are now really scraping to provide enough organs by putting potential donors, healthy donors, at risk. I know of one case where the father was the donor, the son was the recipient, and both the son and the father died as a result of this. So the mother was left with one other child and nothing else. So this shows the lengths we're going to try to resolve these problems. However, coming back to this, they had this cross-circulation. It went very well in the majority of patients, but they realized that this was still not the ideal. For example, if you supported the patient for a period of time, like 30 minutes or so, then things began to start to go wrong. There was an imbalance here, and you really had to sort of wind it up. So they wanted something, and it was still risky for the donor, so they worked on could they get a heart-lung machine to do this. So there was a young man called Richard DeWall, and he trained here, and he went into general practice outside of town. But after a few years, he decided he'd like to be a surgeon. So he came and he saw actually John Lewis, who was still here, and said, could he get onto the residency program? And Lewis said, no, we haven't got a space for you. And when you're a medical student, your grades were rather bad. He was not a stellar student. And we don't think you're up to being on the residency program. So the guy was disappointed, but they said, but you're enthusiastic. We could give you a job as a technician in the animal lab, which is what Lilyhai was running. So Lilyhai took him into this animal lab, and he helped with this cross-circulation for a while. He was one of the people that watched the pump to pump blood from the donor to the recipient back again. And then Lilyhai said to him, look, see if you can develop a heart-lung machine. And people have tried. This guy in Philadelphia's got one. He did one case, but see what you can do. So within about a year, this guy wasn't good enough for the residency program, came up with a very simple oxygenator based on bubbling oxygen in, like you do in a fish tank. And that was easy enough. People have thought about that before, but you have to get the bubbles out again. Otherwise, they all go to the brain if you pump them in. And he managed to have a long tube, and bubbles obviously go up the tube, and fluid comes to the bottom, the blood comes to the bottom. And so he managed to get the bubbles out by just having this long tube, and so the blood that moved on didn't have bubbles. And the interesting thing, he only used this tube because Lilyhai had a friend who ran a mayonnaise factory, and he used lots of tubing. And he said, I've got lots of tubing, I don't want, can you use it? So Lilyhai said to this guy, look, this is all this tubing, and see if you can use it. And that's what gave him the idea of maybe he'd use this tubing. So it was all very much done on a shoestring. Anyway, he came up with this, and they tried it in a number of dogs, and it worked. One interesting thing about that time, which is quite different from today, a lot of the people said to me, you did it in a dog this week. If it worked, you did it in a patient next week. Now, today, as you know, it takes years to get it through the FDA and so on. And many of them said to me, it would never have developed as fast as it did if it had been today, because we couldn't do these things. So they began to try this oxygenator in patients. And the other advantage of it was this oxygenase cost $50 as opposed to $50,000. So it was a bit cheaper. And the other big advantage, which wasn't really noted at the time, I think, was that when you used it, it was only $50, you threw it away. The other ones, you had to clean them very extensively. And after about the second or third use of them, there were toxins in it, chemical toxins and bacterial toxins that you couldn't get rid of. And the third or fourth patient that had this machine being used never did so well as the first patient. But with this one, as you threw it away, every patient was a new patient and everybody did well. So Richard de Waal became really quite fair. He's still alive. He moved on to, forgotten exactly where he went now, I'll remember in a minute, as a surgeon. He was taken on to the residency program after this discovery, of course. And one of the other surgeons I interviewed told me a very nice story. He said that he was on the committee of the American Association for Thoracic Surgery, which is the place, if you're a thoracic surgeon, you want to be prestigious, you become a member of this society, and they're very selective about who they put into it. And he was on the selection committee, the membership committee, and he said, de Waal, who'd now finished his training, sent in his application with his CV and so on, and he said one of the committee members said, well, so he invented the bubble oxygenator, but what's he done since? And it said it reminded this surgeon of a cartoon he'd seen in the New Yorker recently, before that, of cavemen sitting on stones outside a cave with one of them saying, so he invented fire, but what's he done since? So that was, he couldn't believe that this guy who had invented this heart-lung machine was being questioned that should he become a member of this society. So that really established it, because people around the world could then set up or buy a $50 oxygenator. And that's really what got heart surgery going. They didn't have the risk of the patient with the donor. They didn't have the 50,000 development fee for this other thing. And so that's really what it got it off the ground. And thousands of people, thousands of surgeons came to Minnesota. A lot of them had come when they were hypothermia, but a lot more came to see this new heart-lung machine and set it up at home. So the other thing, there's just two more things I want to mention to you about this time here in Minnesota. Maybe many of you know what I'm going to tell you now. But at this time, when they were closing holes in the heart in babies, as they were doing, there is what we call a conducting tissue, which is like a nerve in the heart that runs around the edge of this hole. And it carries the impulse to keep the heart beating at a certain sort of rate, like 70 or 80 minute. And when they were closing this hole, they were putting stitches through to close the hole. They didn't realize where the conducting tissue was in those days. They didn't realize this nerve was there. And so it wasn't uncommon for them to catch it in the stitch. And when they tied the knot, the impulses couldn't go down anymore. And so the patient's heart beat very, very slowly. It has an innate beat of about 20 or 30 a minute, which is not enough to sustain life, really. And so they had this problem of what we call heart block. And it was quite common. And sometimes it would recover spontaneously because maybe the stitch only caught the edge of this conducting tissue. And so after being stunned for a few days, it would recover. But sometimes it didn't recover. And so they were at a meeting one day, and one of the physiologists said, well, we've been pacing muscles in rats and mice by giving an electrical impulse. And so why don't you try an electrical impulse on the heart muscle? And so they went to the lab the same day and got a dog, put a stitch through this conducting area, and started to pace it. That's, again, if I wanted to do that today, I'd have to go through all these committees and put in 50 pages of what I want to do, and then it would come back and they'd ask me a lot of questions. It would take me 3-4 months to get to start. They did it the same day. And they found that this pacing with the electricity would actually do what they wanted it to do. Now, and that gave some time. Maybe the patient would recover spontaneously, because at that time they didn't have permanent pacemakers, but it meant that quite a few of these children recovered. But the problem was, when they were taking the patient from the operating room to the intensive care unit or to the ward afterwards, they had this pacemaker plugged into the wall. And so how were they going to get this patient out there without disconnecting? So what they did, they developed these very, very long wires, and they could take them halfway to the intensive care unit, and they had another wire come the other way, and so halfway through in the corridor, they changed them over and got them back there safely. So Lilyhai thought, well, this is not very efficient. So he called in a guy who used to repair the EKG machines and so on. We tend to think of him like a TV repairman. In fact, he wasn't. He had a degree in electrical engineering, a guy called Earl Bakken, that I'm sure some of you have heard about. And he called in Earl and said, listen, we need some sort of portable pacemaker we can take with the patient. We need a battery and so on. So Earl said, fine, he would do it. And he came up, within a few weeks, he came up with a portable pacemaker. And from that developed all the pacemakers we use today that you put in permanently, the patient walks around, doesn't know they've got it, and a whole new industry developed from this experience. And I just read you one paragraph that is about this company that was found, Medtronic, by Earl Bakken. So in their first month in business in 1949, this was before these heart surgery business, this company had grossed $8. That was it for the month. They ran it, he and his brother-in-law ran it from a garage. After developing the first wearable external cardiac pacemaker in 1957, the company they had formed, Medtronic, went on to manufacture one of the first reliable long-term implantable pacing systems in 1960. By 1963, Medtronic was generating annual sales of almost $1 million, and by 1975, of $100 million. Its yearly revenues had increased to $1 billion by 1991, and to $4 billion by 1999, by which time it employed 20,000 people worldwide. Today, with annual revenues in excess of $13 billion, Medtronic is one of the world's leading medical technology companies. It is one of the great success stories of the early days of medical bioengineering, and it started here at the University of Minnesota when he was asked to come in and provide some sort of pacing system. It's amazing to me you can go from $8 a month to $13 billion a year over the course of one man's lifetime. He's still alive. Earl Bakken is still alive. He lives in Hawaii now, I believe. So it was a great success story. And then Wangenstein, the chairman of the department, who, and a lot of credit has to go to him because he was very open to anybody with any bright ideas. He encouraged them. In fact, one of them said to me, you didn't get your name on the operating list unless you had a completely new operation, because he would encourage a new operation, let's do something new. You know, he was innovative. And it wasn't quite to that extent, but if you had a new operation, you know, there was another guy here at the time who was using dog lungs as the oxygenator for patients. And that wasn't very successful. But everybody was trying something new. And that was Wangenstein's influence. Anyway, when he was retiring, Lilyhai would have liked his job. He wanted to be chairman of the department. But Lilyhai was totally disorganized as a person, administratively, I'm told. And so they didn't appoint him. And John Nigerian, who's still associated with the university, and I just bought a copy of his autobiography just now, and I've met him many, many times. He came in, and his main area of interest was kidney transplantation. So he established what was really an excellent kidney transplantation program here, and Minneapolis has been very known for its transplantation since that time. And he said to Lilyhai, listen, why don't you know, stay, you know, just because you're not chairman, you know, you're doing great work, we want you to stay. But Lilyhai didn't want to stay, he wanted to move, and he was offered a position in Cornell in New York as chairman of surgery there. So after a short time, he moved to New York. And I mentioned that he wasn't very well organized. He was a wonderful surgeon, but he wasn't a person who should administrate a department. In fact, Norman Shumway, one of his great supporters, told me that his tenureship, Lilyhai's tenureship of the professorship at Cornell, made the French Revolution look like a church ice cream social. So it was chaos, evidently. He got into all sorts of troubles there. Things didn't work out very well for him. He was known to like to party. He was one of these remarkable people who could work all day, go out at 10 o'clock at night and have quite a few drinks and come back and be just there sharp the next morning again. But it was not a great success, let's put it that way. And what really was the big problem was that the IRS found that he hadn't been paying his taxes over some years. And I talked to several people about this, and one person who knew him very well said he wasn't surprised because Lilahai, just that didn't bother him. Taxes was unimportant. What was important was looking after his patients and doing all this new stuff. And so he probably just forgot about it and didn't think it was important. In fact, to show how disorganized he was, when he died, this my contact helped his widow sort out his belongings. And in his office at home, in his study at home, he said, "We found $100,000 in notes, just in drawers everywhere." So he just didn't know what he was doing from that point. Anyway, the IRS made a big thing about this. They had a big trial here in St. Paul, I think it was. It lasted 6 weeks. They brought in, I think, 600 witnesses and went through all his personal life and so on. And he'd been taking young ladies out on his NIH grants, which is something... gave me an idea. Maybe I should. That's a good idea. But he was in. It was not a great thing. And they made a thing about it because he was well known, and they wanted to impress upon people, you've got to pay your taxes. He could have gone to prison, but Shumway and Wangenstein people came and spoke and said to the judge, you know, look, this is a man that's done immense humanitarian work and so on. He shouldn't go to prison. So they gave him community service, which he did in New York, but it really ended his career. Cornell more or less put him on permanent leave, and he was only 51 at the time. He did have some sight problems because he'd had a malignant tumor as a young man, and he had a lot of radiation, and I think it has affected his sight as well. But he more or less had to give up surgery. He never operated again, which was very sad. And he became actually advisor to one of the new companies in this area that was making a new heart valve. And he was very valuable to them in designing this valve and making sure it got through. And it was a very successful valve. I used it many times. It was a very, very good valve. And he became a person who really was not accepted by the medical community anymore. People are always ready to stab you in the back if you're down. And the surgical community ignored him for a while. And I went to one or two meetings when I was very young, and I thought that must be Dr. Lilahai there, but he was never the chairman, he was never the speaker, because everybody had ostracized him for a while. But after a little while, John Kirkland, who was at the Mayo Clinic, and his Lilahai's former fellows and trainees held a meeting to sort of rehabilitate him and to recognize his great contributions. And so he gradually was rehabilitated and eventually took his rightful place where it should be, I think, in the history of surgery. I'll tell you one very quick story about that. I was at that meeting. It was in Minneapolis. And Shumway, who by this time was very well known because he was doing all the heart transplants and so on, he spoke. And Shumway has a very black sense of humor. And a very cutting sense of humor. He had great respect for Lilahai. But Lilahai had obviously the mortality had been high when he'd been doing these early operations because people were learning what they were doing. And then he had this big tax problem. So Shumway stood up and said, "You know, Walt," he said, "you always remind me of Al Capone. They couldn't get you on the deaths, but they got you on the taxes." So, and I mean, this was at a meeting to rehabilitate this man and so on. But Walt took it in good part and so on. So so he was rehabilitated and so on. So then, leaving Minneapolis, we then go on to such things as valve replacements, which people made new valves and so on. We go on to the use of human valves, human cadaveric dead valves in patients. One of my bosses in London was the founder of that sort of thing. Then we go on to coronary artery surgery, which opened up heart surgery to millions of patients instead of hundreds and thousands. And then we go on to heart transplantation with the story of Chris Barnard, Norman Shumway, and so on. The first heart transplant ever done was using a chimpanzee heart by James Hardy in Mississippi, not usually very well known. Interesting enough, I've seen the consent form that the patient was going to sign. It's this long. It's one paragraph. The patient couldn't sign it because he was semi-comatose, so his family signed it. It does say that a heart transplant's never been performed before. It makes no mention we might use a chimpanzee heart for us. Can you imagine what we'd have to do today? We'd have a book of lawyers' things. But that was just the way it was at the time. I'm not criticizing, that was just the way it was. So the heart transplantation is a wonderful story. And then we go on to the mechanical heart with people such as DeBakey down in Texas and Cooley, the great surgeons down in Houston, and their development of the artificial heart. So that is the whole story. There's one very poignant short story in here which I want to end with, it comes back to these deaths. One of the surgeons I worked with, one of the very early pioneers in England, was Sir Russell Brock. He eventually became Lord Brock. And we used to say about him that when he got up in the morning and he was looking in the shaving mirror, he would say to himself, "Well, Brock, who are you going to kill today?" Because that was par for the course. And I remember one of my other mentors, who had come into the surgery a little bit later when open heart surgery was just beginning. He used an oxygenator similar to the DeWall one. And I was with him on a ward round once, seeing some patients, and a cardiologist came in and said to him, "Listen, I've got a patient I'd like you to see. He's got a condition that I think you've got a lot of experience of." And the surgeon said to him, "What is it, death?" Because, you know, these guys really, really ate away at them. But the little story I want to tell you was of a surgeon called Dwight Harkin, who was who did some of these closed heart surgeries in Boston at the time. And he used to take these deaths terribly. He would go to bed at night, depressed as could be. And several times he thought he'd give the whole thing up because he just didn't like the best. And one day he went to bed, he came home, the patient had died on the operating table, young woman, and he was very depressed. And somebody delivered a letter to him that evening by hand, and he opened it, and the the patient had written in it, "Thanks for the chance." And I think that sums up that these patients were desperate and they just wanted a chance, and these surgeons had the courage to try. So that's a resume of the story for you, and I hope you'll read it, and I hope you'll enjoy reading it, because I certainly enjoyed putting it together. Thank you. Anybody have any questions at all? Yes, sir.
Actually, I do. I'm interested in the topographies of heart surgery. You said that you had worked at Cape Cod and
Cape Town.
Cape Town, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Don't think they have a heart surgery in Cape Cod. Yeah.
I was wondering, in a way, how this, because I know nothing about it, but I think it does not just take one surgeon, but an entire infrastructure to perform this. So what was so appealing about Haute Chaux in comparison to all these research universities in the US?
Yes, I think you mustn't underestimate Haute Chaux. It was staffed largely by Scots people and English people who were very, very excellent people. I mean, the cardiologists were outstanding. When I worked there, they were the best cardiologists I ever worked with. And Barnard was a very erudite. He had great judgment. I wouldn't say he was intellectually the greatest person in the world, but he had great judgment. He could sense when a heart wasn't doing very well, and he would often say, "I don't like the look of that heart." And you'd say, "Well, why? It looks fine to me." And then 3 minutes later, it would stop beating. And so he had this great judgment. The other thing why he particularly did so well is that he was very ambitious, obviously. But he had, even before he did the first heart transplant, he developed a very good open heart surgery team there. He was completely the boss, the director. He was a very self-centered person in many ways. But he did give the patient an immensely good service. For example, he would hover around the patient for hours after the surgery if he wasn't completely happy the patient was doing well. And it was quite often for him to be there for several hours. Then he'd say to you, "Okay, all right, I'm going back to my office. Call me if there's anything wrong." And you say, "Fine." And it would take him 5 minutes to get to the office, and 5 minutes later, he'd call you. "How's things going?" "They're fine." You know, and he was always hovering. And then he'd come back again. So he was very good at post-operative care, and a lot of people weren't. If you look at the Houston group, particularly Denton Cooley, who was a very gifted surgeon, much better surgeon than Chris Barnard, but he would do 12, 15 cases a day. I've seen one operating list when he did 44 operations in the day, or he and his colleagues. But he would come in and do the difficult bit and then go. And afterwards, he didn't remember one patient from another. And so they got the basic care, the residents on, but Barnard gave them that personal care, and I think that's why he did so well. It's ironic, really, because many of them said to me that in the days of closed heart surgery, when it was the surgeon putting his finger in the valve or this sort of thing, a lot of the surgeons were sort of prima donnas. They were flamboyant personalities. They were the kingpins. When you moved to open heart surgery, where you needed a team of people, as you mentioned, it wasn't the flamboyant guy to some extent. It was the guy that could organize a team and make them all where you needed the anesthesiology, you needed the intensive care, and that was what got it through. So there was a shift in the type of surgeon that came by. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I did. When you're doing a mechanical heart, the regular heart secretes hormones, atrial, naturopathic factor, and all that. How do you supplant the mechanical with those hormones?
Well, I'm not an expert on that. I did a few. I don't do heart surgery anymore. I'm full-time research now. And I've always believed that a biological heart is going to be better than a mechanical heart. And that's my group, we're trying to use pig hearts into it. If you put a pig heart into a human, that has been done, or you put it into a baboon, for example, it'll last on average about 5 minutes, and then it's rejected. 5 minutes. If you put a human heart into a human, you give no treatment, it'll last about a week. But it's 5 minutes. It's an immediate destruction by antibodies and what we call complement. We're out to 8 months now, so we're doing better. And with islets for patients with diabetes, we're out to over a year. So we're beginning to make some progress, but it's taken a long time. But you're right, the mechanical heart, I think, is never going to be quite the answer. I mean, they're very well. What they mainly do today, although this book does cover the actual when they replace the heart, but what we mainly do today is we put in an assist device. You leave the patient's heart, which is not functioning well, and you put in a device that will help it. And they've got very good now, and patients can live a year or two with that assist device. Occasional patient's heart will recover from whatever it was. It's called, say, a viral infection or something. Most of them don't recover. But during that period of time, you try to find them a human heart to transplant it. So you're absolutely right that the mechanical heart, where you replace the heart itself, is not the answer, or certainly not at the minute. And an assist device is a much more optimal way of trying to do it. Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it very much. Bye-bye.